If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
At university, they will never have been taught by a black professor or a professor of colour, which I think is, you know, when you think about it in terms of those kinds of experiences, that is absolutely shocking.
That was Sadia Qureshi talking about black and Asian historians in the UK.
Listening to the History Extra podcast from BBC History Magazine. We're the UK's best-selling history magazine, available in print and several digital formats all over the world. Find out more at historyextra.com/subscribe or look out for us in your digital newsstand or app store.
Hello and welcome to the History Extra podcast. I'm Rob Attar, the editor of BBC History Magazine. Late last year, Olivetta Telly of Bath Spa University became Britain's first ever female black professor of history. This milestone occurred at a time when the ethnic makeup of British history teaching has been under intense scrutiny, especially in light of a Royal Historical Society report that highlighted significant inequalities. We invited Olivette into our studio to explore these issues, alongside Dr. Sadia Qureshi, who is Senior Lecturer in Modern History at the University of Birmingham. Putting the questions to them was our deputy editor, Charlotte Hodgman.
So thank you both of you for coming in to chat with us today. Perhaps we could just start, Sada, you were involved with the recent Royal Historical Society report. What's the sort of background to the report? Why was it done and you know, how did it take place? Who was asked?
A couple of years ago, the Royal Historical Society commissioned a report on gender, and it was examining, in particular, women's experiences within the historical profession. And then recently, we've had a new president, Margot Finn, appointed, and she was very, very keen to follow up on that report with a second one on gender, but also a new one on race. Mm-hmm. So it's a broader attempt by the Royal Historical Society to look into various kinds of inequality within the profession.
Okay. And some of the findings were probably quite surprising to a lot of people. One of the findings was that only 11% of undergrad history students in the UK come from black minority and ethnic backgrounds, which is quite a smaller, you know, percentage of students. Were you surprised by anything that came out?
I don't think I was surprised by the figures because I've paid attention to them for a very long time, and that's partly why I was invited to take part with the report. What I was surprised was the effect of putting it all together and combining it with the results of the surveys that we did. Mm. And it was really quite harrowing reading through some of the kind of responses that we had from people about their experiences. And to me, that was the most kind of shocking aspect. But also, the other thing that did surprise me were that there were several responses to the survey that raised the question of why the RHS was even bothering with it. And that I don't know why I was surprised, but I was surprised that people had bothered to fill out a survey when they thought it was a complete waste of time.
Yeah.
And there were not too many, but there were a few really quite racist responses. So I found that upsetting and surprising. But overall, I think there's been massive support for the whole process, both in terms of the number of people that replied, because there were over 700 respondents, and in terms of trying to make something happen as a result of the report's publication.
Yeah, yeah. Olivette, you must have seen some of the results from the report. What did you make of it?
I wasn't surprised. Mm. It was very important for me to see that report out, because it's basically show what a lot of us have been talking about, and it turned what what people thought to be anecdotes into something that is documented and kind of official, because yeah. it's a report. And it meant that now we can work on doing something about these things, not just individual levels, but institutions and as groups. So, yes.
Yeah. I mean, is this something that's spoken about in sort of history departments? Is it an acknowledged fact that the ratio is of BME students is so low? Is it acknowledged?
Not everywhere. Mm. We know, but we just don't talk about it. And in fact, the people who are talking about it in certain places are the ones who are ostracized, mm. You know, because it falls on the burden to do something becomes yours.
Yeah.
Yours, who sometimes is the discriminated one.
In my experience, people tend not to notice until they're forced to acknowledge it in some way or another. But when those concerns and questions are raised, people are often very, very upset and very self-defensive, because they act on a kind of very individual basis and say, but the problem isn't me.
Yeah.
And so I think it's a very, very difficult thing for people to talk about and to discuss. And so I think it does tend to be go unacknowledged or denied entirely.
Mm. So why do you think that this is the case, that so few BME students are taking history? Because it actually goes back further than just university. I think sort of GCSE and A-level numbers are also quite low. Why is that? Is it to do with what we're teaching in schools, or is there, you know, something else that's going on?
Probably a combination of reasons, mm. and it depends on the context as well. In some places, actually, history is a popular topic, especially when it's related to people's communities and people's history. In some places in London, they're quite keen to talk about Black British history. In other places like Wales, where I do live, we never talk about it. It's not taught in classes. It's not part of what they call regional history.
Yeah.
So the numbers are, the number varied. But what I would say is that there's this idea that who teaches you matters just as much as what is taught. So if you can't see yourself or have people who look like you talking about histories that matters to you, then people will tend to move away from that. Mm-hmm. But I mean, these are just one of the many reasons, I'd say.
Yeah, because that was another finding, wasn't it, that academics as well, of BME academics are very underrepresented as well in universities. What have been your experiences, both of you, you know, in your career? Have you sort of faced discrimination, sort of bias against you? You're smiling. I'm guessing that this is a yes.
Go on.
I think we both have, and honestly, I'd be quite surprised if any academic of colour hadn't at least experienced microaggressions and so on. And for most, as the report shows, over a third have experienced something beyond that in terms of abuse or more extensive discrimination. So I think it is actually quite pervasive, and it manifests itself in many, many different ways in terms of both individual experiences, but also structurally. Yeah. I mean, Olivet just this year has become the first Black woman to be made a professor of history in the UK, which is an extraordinary achievement and wonderful. But also, it's 2018. This is absolutely shocking. And I think it's a national disgrace that it hasn't happened earlier, both in Olivet's career, but more broadly. And that is something that I think very few people understood when that happened, the significance of that. Likewise, Hakeem Adi, the first Black professor, was only made professor a few years ago. I don't know the exact date. But, you know, for most students of history that have ever read this subject at university, they will never have been taught by a Black professor or a professor of colour, which I think is, you know, when you think about it in terms of those kinds of experiences, that is absolutely shocking.
Yes, I completely agree. And I would say that people seem to be surprised. I'm probably less perhaps kind that you, when you said that, it tend to not notice. I think they notice, but academia is also a place where there's a lot of competition. It's very hard to have a permanent post and all that. So the issue of race are, for me, people know, but it's just so competitive that race, among other things, comes on top of that. And I would say that as far as students not being able to identify this, students of colour, they notice things and they move away precisely from the subject because it's, the, you know, consciously or unconsciously, they just decide it's not for them.
Yeah, because I mean, the first female professor, I think, was, I looked it up and it was sort of 90 odd years ago, I think it was. We had the first female professor in British university, and like you say, it's taken till 2018. For, I mean, congratulations. I mean, it's like Sadia says, it's a great achievement, but it has taken such a long time.
I think 2018 is particularly important because it's 20 years since the first women of colour became professors at all in any subject, which are Heidi Mirza and Lola Young. And so it's taken 20 years, you know, 70 years longer than it took for any women to become professor, and then another 20 years within history. So this is a very, very serious problem across academia. But it is particularly bad within history, as the RHS report shows, that as a discipline, it's significantly more problematic than others.
Have you found that being a woman of colour, do you find that you it's harder to get on as an academic than perhaps a man of colour? Do you think you've got that additional kind of bias and perhaps discrimination as well?
I'd probably say yes, but it works for not just for academia. People would in any really profession. If you look across, I don't know, the media or things like that, you will find first a man of colour and way, way later on, they will hire a woman of colour.
Yeah.
So there's this sexist, racist thing going on that seems to be not accepted, but as the norm. I don't know why. I don't understand why, and I completely disagree. But this is how it works. Yes.
Yeah. I mean, Oliver, you studied in France. Is it similar situation there? Is this just a British thing, or is it similar?
I always say that France as a whole has a high number of racists. But in academia, things are completely different the way you enter into academia. The system is fair in the sense that it's a national kind of a national recruitment, national exam. It means that people who are likely to recruit you are not necessarily people you know or who are around you. And it's about a jury of 20 people. And if there is collusion, it becomes really harder. Right. And once you have that post, it's based on very precise things as the number of publications, the number of years of admin duties, and it's very precise, not on somebody's feelings about whoever you are, which means that there's a higher number of academics of colour and black people academics, which is quite surprising given the fact that France is known as to be institutionally racist.
Yeah.
But in academia, it doesn't work that way.
So, do you think the system needs to change? Do you think is that partly at fault in Britain?
I think so. I think that this idea that sometimes it's to do with people liking you or not liking you or their feelings about your colour is completely ridiculous, and I don't understand it.
What would you like to see change, Sadia? Anything sort of, do you think, obviously not a quick fix, but, you know, what can be done, do you think, by universities to help make things more equal?
Well, the report sets out various kinds of recommendations that can happen at various kinds of at various levels. So, for instance, one of the things that absolutely needs to happen is that students of colour need much, much better support while they're at university. There's an enormous attainment gap between white students and those of colour in terms of the number achieving first. They're about as equally likely to get two ones, but the number achieving first. And so, you know, better attention needs to be paid there. But we also ran a focus group as part of putting the race report together. And students were very clear that the subject needs to be made more relevant to them and more interesting. They are completely and utterly put off by the curriculum, which they see as heavily dominated by Eurocentrism and whiteness in very, very damaging ways. So it needs to be changed both at the level of university curricula, but earlier on, the recruitment processes need to change. There needs to be much better support. People need to be hired. Staff of colour need to be hired to provide the role models that these students want. And those and the staff that are there, as well as new recruits, need to much, much better support to develop their careers. For instance, one of the things that often happens to staff of colour is that they get asked to do all sorts of diversity work, which is effectively asking them to fix their own oppression, while people who are not marginalised don't have to do this work. And it's often dismissed with respect to prestige or promotion and so on. But it's very, very hard work. And at the same time, there's a lot of additional labour involved in being an academic of colour because of the support that students ask us for. So there's lots of ways that things could be made significantly better, quite easily, actually.
I mean, has anything improved, do you think? I mean, the report only came out a couple of months ago in October. But do you think over the last few years, things have got better in any sort of sense, you know, around this topic?
The numbers are very, very slowly improved. So that's a form of progress. And we have individual promotions that are forms of progress. But structurally and institutionally, there's been very little change. And that's what needs to change to create a much, much kind of more comprehensive transformation that's needed.
Yes, I completely agree. And I would say that the burden of working on oppression, there's also gender. Women are expected in academia. Many women are expected to sort out student problems, as in listen, you know, they're supposedly better listeners. So, so you have being a woman of colour, where you ask that extra bit to do. And we also know that in terms of numbers, women of colour are less likely to be in permanent post. So there's this precarity as well that goes with it. The structure needs to change.
So in your own personal careers, do you think being a woman of colour in academia today is better than when you were first starting out?
This is interesting because throughout my career, I've always been supported by many women from various backgrounds, and that hasn't changed. They've remained constant.
Yeah.
So I don't think that on that side something majorly important has changed. What has changed is being able to tell men through that report that this is what's happening. Look at this. Now it's your turn to do something, not just hire behind. We're all academics. We know for a fact that, for example, mothers as well have a harder time in academia to cope with the level of duties. And therefore, in terms of promotion, their career is slower because they're mothers, because they're women of colour, and because they're women generally. So, as I said, having that report is wonderful.
So you're hopeful that things will change as a result, that this report will be taken seriously and it'll be and the recommendations that have been made will sort of be listened to and read by universities. Are you hopeful for that? Do you think it will?
Within days of the report's publication, there was national press coverage, but also many institutions had been in touch with the RHS asking if they could hold events and so on. So I think there will be a flurry of activity and I think there will be all sorts of change. But whether that change translates into long-term institutional and structural changes that benefit academics, staff, students of colour is a different matter. I think there will be changes and I think I'm hoping many of them will be positive, but making sure that that initial enthusiasm translates into structural change, I think, is something that the RHS will need to keep paying attention to, and the institutions will need to keep paying attention to.
There's one thing I would say is the equality, is it the national equality? No, there's work being done or commissioned is it in December that universities are supposed to show their a kind of ethnicity, racial pay gap?
Yes.
Yeah. And that is quite important as well, because it needs to be part of this conversation.
Yeah. Because there was a recent report, wasn't there? And that was, I think it was 22 leading universities. There was a survey, I think, by the BBC. I'm not quite sure.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
And that was quite surprising. I mean, were you surprised by the gap? I mean, like an average of 26%?
Not at all. I wasn't surprised at all. What was interesting for me is that Rihanna, I know her, focused on Russell Group's.
Yes.
Russell Group. And that is a first step. Now, we need to look at other universities who are hiding behind, oh, we're too small, we're not part of the Russell, to do all sort of things. So it needs to be national. But that initial report was incredibly important and is still incredibly important to start that conversation as well as the others.
The Russell Group, it's the 24 leading universities, isn't it?
Research-intensive universities.
Okay.
Yeah,
and I think 22 of those responded to the survey, and that's how they got that average of 26%, and even less for I think it was even more of a gap for females.
Yes.
It's a big gap. Looking at schools now, do you think changing the curriculum as early sort of primary school and having more kind of global history, focusing on that in the classroom, do you think that's going to help increase numbers? So do you think we need to go back that early in children's sort of school careers to kind of get more people into sort of studying history and humanities?
I think getting children involved and interested in history as young as possible is really, really important. And there are many ways that can be done, whether that's through the school curriculum or whether it's through history TV programming, for instance. I was, last weekend, I was at a talk where there was a room full of children watching a TV presenter give a talk about history, and it was wonderful to see them so excited at that kind of age. And the important thing is not just to get them interested in the first place, but keep them interested by telling them about a varied range of histories that they may never otherwise encounter.
Mm. Yeah, definitely.
Yes, I believe that too. We completely agree. Not marginalised history as well. Certain histories really show them that, the history that concern people of colour is also part of British history. So it's global history, but it's also national history. And they're very receptive. And once they kind of integrated that, it just grows, which means that by the time they reach secondary school, they're not going to tell you that this is a special kind of history. It's just part of their history as well.
Yeah. Is there anything else in the report that you think that you would like to highlight as being particularly sort of significant?
There are so many things that I think are important about the report. I think one of the most important is the insistence that this is a shared task that must be shared by everyone across academia, and that many people who have previously not paid attention to these things now need not only to start noticing, but to start contributing labour. And that's the only way that this will change structurally, if people pay attention, and then it needs to be a sustained effort. And I think one of the other really, really important points is that we need to get away from the idea that it's possible that universities are somehow spaces that exist outside of society's broader prejudices. I think academics especially like to think of themselves on the whole as being intelligent, liberal and so on, and somehow free from the kind of prejudices we're talking about. And that is absolutely not the case. You can't walk onto a university campus and leave behind all the kind of social conditioning that we experience and are subject to outside of campuses. And that really needs to be taken seriously. Universities are not these kind of pure objective spaces in which discrimination can never possibly flourish. To me, that's one of the most important things.
Yeah, because you sort of think of them as these sort of safe spaces, like you say. But by the sounds of it, it's not the case for
many people.
No. Yeah. Do you think this sort of discrimination and bias does it extend beyond academia and into when you're trying to get published, speaking at events, have you experienced anything along those lines outside of the sort of university space?
I would say two things, just to come back to your last comment about universities not being those safe spaces. We've seen recently students being discriminated against in main national headlines. Students of colour, and it's damaging. And at the time when we're talking a lot about questions of suicide in campuses and things like that, I think we need to have that conversation as well. What it does, people being isolated and not being able to reach out when they need help. There's a mental health issue, but there's also the accumulation of mental health and racism that makes people do things, but also leave academia altogether. So we need to talk about that. In terms of us encountering discrimination, it's always there. In terms of publishing, I'll talk now as a French speaker, and French is my first language. I would say that there's discrimination there, because the assumption is you can't really write English properly, and therefore you're discarded before you started. There's the big publishers, as in the big, I won't name names, that are not expecting you to send them papers. And I know from experience that you have to go through a network of people to actually get published sometimes. And it's difficult, because if you don't have that network, obviously you didn't build your career here, it becomes harder. And I'm thinking about those academics of colour who are working a lot with communities and who have an enormous amount of information and knowledge that is not considered to be academic enough to be published. And I find it heartbreaking, because we're missing out. The profession is missing out on a wealth of information.
Yeah, I think there are often very unhelpful and rigid distinctions drawn between academic history, public history, community history, for instance, that often marginalises people of colour, because they might not have been to the most elite institutions, they might not have built up the most prestigious networks and so on. And even when they have, I mean, I went to an extremely prestigious institution for my education, there are still barriers that one faces. Mm. So I think, it's a very, very difficult environment for people to establish themselves, especially when precarity is becoming increasingly kind of difficult to negotiate within the profession, and then to secure jobs and so on.
That was Professor Olivette Otelli and Dr. Sadia Qureshi in conversation with our deputy editor, Charlotte Hodgman. And look out for video clips of this discussion, which will appear soon at our website, historyextra.com. And we've now reached the end of today's episode, but we will be back on Thursday to discuss the history of the Holocaust.
Thanks for listening to this History Extra podcast, which was produced by Jack Fletcher. Do let us know what you think about this episode by emailing podcast@historyextra.com, and we might read out your messages in future editions. Alternatively, why not keep in touch via Twitter or Facebook, where you'll find us at History Extra. For more great history content, don't forget to visit our website, historyextra.com, which is full of history articles, quizzes, image galleries, and more. Plus, it's where you can download hundreds of previous episodes of this podcast.